3681. I represent appellant Marla Yeltner. I want to begin the argument by stating that the trial court below focused on whether Dr. Mitchell was a CU employee and not an independent contractor, and he focused on two tests, the relative work test and the control test. But that's misguided in our view. That is not the issue here. Ms. Geltner conceded that Dr. Mitchell was a CU employee. What she argued below and argues here is that Dr. Mitchell was acting as an independent contractor when he was over at TCH, which names now change, but it was the Children's Hospital. And what we say is that based upon the record and the testimony at the Trinity hearing shows that CU lifted its whole pediatric department and put it over TCH and entered into what we call, I believe, is a de facto joint venture or partnership, which is not a public entity, and performed pediatric services under that entity's umbrella. And Dr. Mitchell was assigned over there, and he was working for the joint venture or partnership. And therefore, immunity under our statute, the Colorado Government and Mental Immunity Act, doesn't apply to a private entity. And the partnership or arrangement between CU and TCH is not a public entity. And therefore, Dr. Mitchell is not entitled to immunity.
Mr. Glazer?
Yes.
When did you first raise this theory that there was a joint venture or partnership as to which the doctor was an agent?
Well, we raised it in our proposed findings, but you may be referring to when did we raise the argument about the dual agents. We raised that on reconsideration of the judge's November 25 order.
All right, and what is the difference between your argument, dual agency argument, and your joint venture argument?
First comes the joint venture argument. You have to have that to have a dual agency, in our view. And that's what we have here. And we think the judge ignored those facts. Rather than examining both sides' contentions, he simply focused on whether Dr. Mitchell was a CU employee. We conceded that he was. But what the judge should have done is focus on how did Dr. Mitchell act, who controlled his conduct while he was over working for this joint venture or partnership. He didn't do that. And therefore, he didn't make the appropriate findings.
It seems to me your theory initially was that despite the fact that the doctor was a public employee, he was an agent or an independent contractor of the hospital specifically.
We said that because of the agreements. We actually had two arguments. The agreement in our proposed findings was that he was an independent contractor for TCH based upon the myriad of agreements, which so said that Dr. Mitchell was, or CU was, and its people were independent contractors, not only in the master agreement between the two entities, but the which we say also formed a partnership, but in the affiliation agreement and the personal service agreements that Dr. Mitchell had entered into with other hospitals. And incidentally, if he were not an independent contractor, the agreement between Dr. Mitchell and Presbyterian St. Luke's for pediatric cardiac services wouldn't have provided that the St. Luke's, Presbyterian St. Luke's was going to cover him for malpractice. That would not have been necessary if he was a public employee because he would have had immunity while he's working over there. So that provision in that agreement is not superfluous. And CU conceded through its attorneys that those agreements would be samples. Those agreements would apply if Dr. Mitchell, if we had a written agreement in effect between CU and TCH and Dr. Mitchell. They didn't have that. It was never produced. So whether they entered into it or not, their counsel represented to the court that these two agreements between Dr. Mitchell, actually CU and Exempla and Presbyterian St. Luke's, were representative of what would have been if they followed the agreement and entered into the personal service agreements involving Dr. Mitchell.
Right.
TCH, so.
What I'm trying to do, though, is try to figure out exactly which theories you asserted when. It seems to me you asserted this theory that he was an independent contractor of the hospital up through the time of trial. And then after trial, there was this new theory that he was also an agent of a partnership or joint venture between the hospital and the university.
Let me answer your question. In the proposed findings, we argued that he was an independent contractor of the hospital. Then on reconsideration, we argued that he also was not only that, but he was a dual agent of the of a joint venture.
Okay, and why is this latter theory timely?
Well, we think it is. It's logical extension of the independent contractor argument, because it means that he's not, that Dr. Mitchell would not have been a, he would have been an independent contractor of the hospital or the entity either way. It's a logical extension. After we heard the testimony and focused on it, and focused on the judge's opinion, where he said in paragraph 40 of his order that CU was an independent contractor, he didn't, and CU can only act through its people, we thought, well, if that's the case, then he has to be an agent, a dual agent of this entity. He could be an agent of CU or the other entity, but he was working for this private public entity, which is not covered by the statute. We raised that a reconsideration, and we believe the judge did consider that. He considered it timely because we filed our motion reconsideration in timely, and he waited. He issued an order. He denied it. He didn't let it pass in 60 days and deem it denied. He actually affirmatively took action to deny the motion, which in our minds means he read that argument and didn't agree with it. I think he, in our mind, he felt it was appropriate to be considered on reconsideration.
Pardon me, Mr. Glazer, if I may, please. I want to ask you a question about the scope of the of this dual agent, this joint venture argument that you are urging upon us. If your argument is successful, why then would any government entity ever work with a private entity again? Because your argument would suggest that in all those situations, the government entities would lose their governmental immunity. And it strikes me that there are a whole lot of benefits out of this arrangement. So why don't you tell me why this wouldn't, you know, basically shut down such arrangements?
Well, first of all, I don't know how many public-private arrangements there are. I don't think it's a matter of working with somebody. I think it's a matter of entering into an arrangement which constitutes a de facto joint venture or partnership. Sure, you can have contracts between two entities. There's nothing wrong with that. That doesn't mean that you would have the contract. That doesn't mean that you wouldn't have governmental immunity for government employees working under that contract or with the other contracted party. What we're talking about here is an arrangement which is more formal. And we're not talking about a contract just between two people. We're talking about a contract that specifically says we're partnering with these people. And I don't believe you're going to find any contract arrangement between a public entity and a private organization that says we're partnering. It'll be a straight contract where one party has obligations, the other party has obligations, and that's it.
Well, in this context, though, you would agree, would you not, that it is CU that has the agreement with Children's, and it is not Dr. Mitchell personally who entered into that agreement?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. In any event, so let me just get to the still argument. If you find that we're correct in our analysis that our argument was timely, I think it was, and that there is a partnership for joint arrangement de facto, that cannot become a public entity under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, which means Dr. Mitchell doesn't have the immunity. That's the crux of our argument. We also still depend upon and rely upon the independent contractor argument with CCH because of the language in the agreements. If he's not an independent contractor, if CU was found to be an independent contractor, can only operate through his people. And therefore, Dr. Mitchell had to be an independent contractor. And the reason I say that is that under those agreements, TCH controlled Dr. Mitchell's conduct, not CU. They controlled his academic requirements, but they didn't control how he functioned as an administrator or in providing clinical services.
If I may return, pardon me for interrupting, but if I may return to a point you made earlier and just repeat it, you suggest that there is some issue with the fact that these other contracts with Exempla and the other hospital had other provisions in them. Well, neither of those is represented here in this case. This case has to do with the Children's Hospital. And in this case, as I read the various provisions, it's clear that Dr. Mitchell is CU's employee. It's clear that they pay him. And it is even clear in Section 12.4 that he is immune under the doctrine of governmental immunity. So I understand that if Exempla were here, that might be important. But that's not the agreement that we have here. And well, if your argument has to do with the agreement, don't we have to look to the agreement?
Well, what the record shows is that the parties never carried out Section 4.2a of that agreement to enter into a personal service agreement like it was supposed to. But CU's counsel represented that they should have, and it would look just like the Exempla and the St. Luke agreement. So our view is that that's what you'd have to look to see what Mitchell's requirements were when he was working over at TCH under the independent contractor argument. Do you understand what I'm saying? Maybe
I understand what you're saying.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. I'd like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal. So I just want to wrap up. We cited the Vargo case at pages 29 and 29 and 30 of our brief, and we think that case, although a Michigan case, is instructive. The facts are very similar to what happened here. And we realize that, you know, if you find there was a partnership, certainly it would make a big difference in the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. But it's really unfair. I think it's really unfair and equitable to patients who go to CU to find that and they don't know whether a doctor there is a CU employer. It's not even publicized. But if you have a joint venture like this, these entities should be held responsible when they enter into an arrangement like this, where they wholesale pick up and take a department over to another hospital and operate out of there as a joint venture. And under the documents, we think it's pretty clear that TCH controlled Dr. Mitchell's conduct when he was running the ECMO program, not CU. And the documents make it clear that he was subject to the board of directors' control of the board of directors of TCH. He was under their control all the way. Not in academic matters, but as far as his conduct over there. His conduct occurred during his management and restructuring of the ECMO program.
Counsel, I realize you want to save some time, but I've got to ask you about, you talk about fairness, but didn't your client sign a release? I mean, your client expressly released the hospital and the hospital's agents and the hospital's affiliates from any liability relating to her employment. And yet your argument is that the doctor was an agent of the hospital. Well, if that's right, then she released him.
No, we're not arguing he's an agent of the hospital. We're saying he was an agent of the joint venture.
Well, that was your new argument. Your first argument, as you just said a minute ago in your findings of fact, was that he was an agent of the hospital.
No, we said he was an independent contractor of the hospital.
What's the difference?
Well, I think the difference is that an independent contractor controls his work. He's not acting. He's not.
But you said the hospital contract controlled his work. Which is it?
The hospital controls not his work. The hospital controls his conduct as he's over there doing managing and supervising, not his academic matters. An independent contractor, they would control the work, but it would be under a contract which has specifics in it. And here we don't have that. All we have is he's subject to the board of directors' direction while he's over there, and he has to adhere to their requirements. Let me give an example. We're not saying the hospital controls how he performs his medical surgery. What we're saying is if they have standards where say you need 5 nurses in the operating room, he can't controvert that and say I only want 3. He has to follow their requirements, and that's how they control what he does when he's in the operating room, not how he operates. That's his medical judgment. And I don't even think CU controls that, but.
Do you have any legal authority that would say that this independent contractor is not an agent of the hospital?
I don't have any here today.
Okay, well, I didn't see any in the briefs either. It seems to me you're arguing on the one hand he's an agent for some purposes and not an agent for purposes of the release.
Well, we think he was an agent on our new argument that we raised that it was a different entity, not TCH. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. You've got about 30 seconds left.
May it please the court, I'm Carrie Hershey, bar number 34246, and I represent Dr. Max Mitchell, who since July 1998 has been a full-time cardiothoracic surgeon for the University of Colorado. As acknowledged both in plaintiff's briefs and in argument here today, there are several things that are undisputed. First, that Dr. Mitchell is an employee of the University of Colorado. It is also undisputed that the university is a public employer. And it is also undisputed in this case that no notice of claim was ever filed under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. To avoid the results of these undisputed facts, plaintiff seeks to parse out the responsibilities of Dr. Mitchell and reclassify some of his responsibilities as those of an independent contractor or an agent of a joint venture. The fundamental flaw in this argument is that the plain language of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act and the jurisdictional factual findings after a full evidentiary hearing that was conducted after the plaintiff was allowed to conduct discovery into the issues surrounding Dr. Mitchell's governmental employment demonstrated that at all relevant times, Dr. Mitchell was a full-time public employee who was acting within the course and scope of that public employment, and the trial court found that there was no evidence to the contrary. Accordingly, to find in favor of plaintiff here today, this court would have to change the language of the Governmental Immunity Act and overturn the factual findings of the trial court after a Trinity hearing. The Act and the language of the Act is important here. It includes both a broad definition of public employee and also it expressly defines a public employee to include any healthcare practitioner who's employed by a public entity. There are only two times when that exception doesn't apply to a healthcare practitioner who's an employee of a public entity. That's when the healthcare practitioner is not a full-time employee and when the healthcare practitioner has their own independent private practice. Neither of those facts are present here. The undisputed evidence is that Dr. Mitchell has been a full-time employee of the university since 1998, and there is no evidence that he has any outside or independent practice. In fact, the evidence was that his university employment prohibits him from conducting any outside employment activities. Importantly, also, the Governmental Immunity Act contemplates a scenario and expressly provides for a scenario where a healthcare practitioner who is employed by the university provides those services at a non-public entity. Thus, the legislative intent was clear that healthcare providers, whether they're providing services at the public entity or at a non-public entity, remain governmental employees for purposes of the Act unless they're not practicing full-time and they have an independent practice. The trial court heard the evidence and resolved the jurisdictional facts in Dr. Mitchell's favor and found that he was a full-time faculty employee at all relevant times and that all the conduct complained of or alleged to have happened in this case happened within the course and scope of Dr. Mitchell's public employment. And if we can take a step back and take a look at some of the evidence that was actually presented at the Trinity hearing, it's clear why the court found this. It starts with the offer letter to Dr. Mitchell in 1998. Which talks about the fact that Dr. Mitchell is part of his responsibilities are not only clinical responsibilities, but also to help develop programs and promote surgical care. That concept is carried on into his faculty contract, which is entered into, and provides that he will serve on committees and also have involvement with necessary special programs. The testimony at the Trinity hearing was unanimous, with Dr. Mitchell testifying, Dr. Lowenstein, who is the Dean of Faculty Affairs, and Chancellor Lily Marks also testifying. All three testified that Dr. Mitchell's activities at the Children's Hospital were part and parcel of his university employment, including his service on the ECMO task force.
Pardon me, Ms. Hershey, would you please address Mr. Glazer's argument concerning the independent contractor issue?
Sure. Plaintiff argues that Dr. Mitchell somehow becomes an independent contractor because he's performing administrative work as opposed to clinical work. And this argument essentially creates an artificial bifurcation of tasks that is not present in the plain language of the Act. The Governmental Immunity Act defines a public employee to be any, to include any healthcare practitioner who's employed by a public entity. It doesn't distinguish between when somebody's performing administrative services as a public employee or clinical services as a public employee. So the test is not the task that somebody's performing. The test is whether or not it's within the course and scope of the person's public employment. And in this case, there's no question that service on committees promoting surgical care at university teaching sites, that those things are part and parcel of Dr. Mitchell's public employment. It doesn't make him an independent contractor simply because the university has an affiliation agreement with teaching sites. And in fact, Judge Bernard, you mentioned earlier the question of whether or not this interpretation would halt the benefits that the public receives from having these types of affiliations with outside entities. It's there's no dispute, and the university has never disputed, that it shares a common goal with Children's Hospital in providing a world-class pediatric program. It does this because facilitating such an environment offers university employees and students the best possible education and research experience. To that end, as part of their public employment, faculty members such as Dr. Mitchell provide services to committees that foster that type of learning environment. This furthers the educational mission of the university. The fact that those services may also be a benefit to Children's Hospital does not make this some form of joint venture, and it does not convert Dr. Mitchell into an independent contractor of the private entity. He remains a public employee.
If I may ask one more question based upon that. Mr. Glazer suggests that there is some distinction between his actions as a treating physician and his actions as an administrator. Could you address that distinction for me, please?
Absolutely. One, I think, again, it's an artificial distinction because administrative tasks and clinical tasks are intertwined. If you don't develop good surgical programs, you can't practice good clinical surgery. And no more than your honor's service on rules committees would somehow be outside of your employment as public employment as officers of this court. There is no distinction in the Governmental Immunity Act between the types of services somebody is providing. The question is the service being provided within the course and scope of public employment? And the trial court in this case heard testimony on that, took evidence on that, and determined that Dr. Mitchell's service on the ECMO task force and his involvement with the ECMO program was part and parcel of his university employment. I also wanted to address a couple of the factors that Mr. Glazer raised, because he indicated that the question here was who had the right to control Dr. Mitchell's employment and the terms of his employment. And the undisputed evidence at trial was that the university has the right to control the circumstances of Dr. Mitchell's employment. The university decides what location Dr. Mitchell's going to provide services at. And in this case, it determined that Dr. Mitchell would provide services two-thirds time at TCH and one-third time at University Hospital. That decision of where Dr. Mitchell performs services is completely within the university's discretion. The university decides and can veto what committees Dr. Mitchell serves on. They can tell him to serve on certain committees and not on others. It is the university who controls those issues. It's also the university who pays Dr. Mitchell. The undisputed evidence, which included his pay stubs and testimony, show that only the university pays Dr. Mitchell. Only the university provides Dr. Mitchell benefits of employment. Only the university can promote or terminate Dr. Mitchell's employment. So Mr. Glazer's suggestion that TCH somehow, I think he said TCH controlled Dr. Mitchell's conduct, but there is no evidence of that. That is simply plaintiff's argument that somehow TCH controlled Dr. Mitchell when performing these administrative functions. But there was no evidence that TCH controlled Dr. Mitchell in performing administrative functions. The only thing that Mr. Glazer points to are the TCH bylaws, which provide that the TCH Board of Directors is ultimately responsible for the care that's provided in its facility. But that issue simply relates to whether or not a doctor has privileges at a hospital. If you took Mr. Glazer's argument to its logical conclusion, every doctor in the state who provided a surgery or performed a procedure at any hospital would become the employee of that hospital. And that's simply not the case. Doctors have privileges at hospitals that require them to comply with certain bylaws and that also give them rights to practice at those facilities. That doesn't mean that those facilities become their employer. And I'd like to just touch also on this argument that plaintiff makes regarding this partnership agency, joint venture, joint enterprise theory. They've used those terms interchangeably throughout the brief and a little bit here today. And I think that argument is unpersuasive for two critical reasons. First and foremost, all of those things under Colorado law have a clearly established meaning. And it requires an agreement to share in profits and share in losses. And there is absolutely no evidence before this court, there was no evidence in the trial court, that the university and Children's ever agreed to share in profits and losses. They simply did not. And in fact, plaintiff in their opening brief at page 4 acknowledges as much and states that Children's is a separate entity with its own bottom line. There's simply no evidence that there was any sharing of profits and losses that would create a de facto partnership. The other part of that argument was that there were statements in the affiliation agreement that the university would partner with institutions such as Children's to offer unique strengths. This is directly from the agreement, offer unique strengths as a top Children's hospital in affiliation with a leading academic institution. Statements that the university is going to partner to offer unique strengths as a top Children's hospital in affiliation with a leading academic institution does not convert the affiliation into a legal partnership or joint venture. It simply does not. And importantly, you have to go back to the language of the Governmental Immunity Act that provides that an employee like Dr. Mitchell is a public employee unless he's not employed full-time or has his own independent practice. So in sum, plaintiffs can't escape the fact that Dr. Mitchell is a full-time public employee who was, as the trial court found based on the evidence in the record, acting within the course and scope of his public employment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hershey. Your time is up.
Since I only have 30 seconds, I'm going to use the full second. First of all, the offer letter in 1998 was signed by TCH and CU. Why does TCH have to sign it? Because there was a joint venture arrangement. Otherwise, there's no need to have their signature on it. They had to be approving Dr. Mitchell and his partner arrangement. Number two, Ms. Hershey says there's no evidence that there was a joint venture. Well, the agreements themselves are that TCH didn't have control over Dr. Mitchell. Indeed, it did, because the agreements say so in section 1.2 of the affiliation agreement, the master agreement, say that he's subject to the board of directors. It's not just the bylaws. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I appreciate it. Well, counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. We appreciate very much you coming to our new courthouse. And, you know, if you have a few moments to wander around and take a look, we certainly encourage you to do so. This is your courthouse. This is the public's courthouse. And so please come take a look at your courthouse. That being said, I wish you all a safe journey home. And with that, the bailiff will announce the recess.